Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran and Moscow are looking to boost cooperation in various sectors, including trade. Search and rescue operations are underway in eastern Afghanistan one day after a powerful earthquake killed more than 1,000 people. Also ahead, European Union leaders convene in Brussels to decide whether or not to grant candidate status to Ukraine. Hello and welcome from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Good to have you with us. Good with our top story this hour. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran and Moscow are working on an agreement for long-term comprehensive cooperation.
We also discussed the treaty for comprehensive strategic and long-term cooperation between the two states. And this has been on our agenda prior to the trip by President Raisi to Russia. We hope to hold experts meeting very soon in order to finalize the contents of the agreement. And also other matters on the agenda. We came up with very good agreements.
Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a joint press conference with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov. In Tehran, he said the two countries are looking to expand bilateral trade and boost cooperation in various sectors, including railway transit. The top Iranian diplomat also commented on the war in Ukraine, saying the U.S. is using NATO to implement its agenda. The minister said Tehran believes a diplomatic approach is the only way to resolve the conflict. On the JCPOA revival talks, he said Tehran hopes the U.S. will take a realistic approach and remove the sanctions to pave the way for a final agreement on reviving the 2015 Iran deal. Lavrov, for his part, said Moscow fully supports the restoration of the JCPOA without any unacceptable additions.
We once again confirm to our Iranian friends that we will fully support their position about the revival of Iran's 2015 nuclear deal with no exceptions and unacceptable additions. This implies cancellation of all the illegal sanctions.
Lavrov said all illegal anti-Iran sanctions that contradict the JCPOA must be lifted. The Russian top diplomat said Moscow and Tehran condemn what he called an unacceptable practice of illegal unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its allies. He said the two states are working to counter such measures. He said Moscow and Tehran both reject the concept of the so-called rule-based order prompted by Western powers. The numerous acts of sabotage that Israel has committed against Iran, from assassinating its nuclear scientists to damaging its nuclear facilities, are an open secret. But Iran says Israel's covert operations have weakened in the face of its security apparatus. The judiciary has revealed the arrest of three Mossad-linked agents who had the intent of killing Iranian nuclear scientists.
Iran has released fresh details about the covert and planned operations of agents of Israeli spy agency in Iran. Officials say the three agents detained back in April were planning to assassinate Iranian nuclear scientists. Officials say the agents were arrested following a complicated intelligence operation that lasted 8 months. Judiciary officials say some members of the cell have been arrested in Iran's southeastern Sistan and Balochistan province, while other members and operatives have been detained outside the province by Iran's intelligence forces. Officials say the case is under preliminary investigation and that an indictment would be filed and sent to court soon. This is not the first time Iran busts Mossad-linked terrorists. In July last year, Iran's intelligence ministry arrested a network of agents with the Israeli Mossad spy agency at the western borders, confiscating a large cache of weapons and ammunition that they were planning to use to provoke riots and terror inside the country.
Well, of course there should be, and I don't think anyone is really going to seriously say it's unthinkable that Israel would try to assassinate Iranian figures whether in science or politics, they've got a demonstrable propensity to do so, and they boast about it.
The arrests come amid open threats by Israeli officials against Iranian nuclear scientists and facilities. The regime is notorious for its sabotage activities and assassinations in Iran.
And the reason behind its stepped-up hostility toward Iran, and a very open hostility, is that Israel seeks to be the lone superpower, or you could say mini superpower of the region, as a junior partner of the big superpower, the United States.
Israel has been trying to halt Iran's civilian nuclear program throughout the years, but it's been unsuccessful. Those efforts include influencing the IAEA reports by providing the agency with false information about Iran's nuclear activities. Still, the failure of the international community in holding Israel to account has emboldened the regime to pursue its plots for assassination and sabotage.
Israel has tried various ways to stop Iran's nuclear progress. They include acts of sabotage, assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, as well as threats to bomb Iran's nuclear installations. Probably the most high-profile assassination was the killing of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a top Iranian nuclear scientist who was brutally murdered by Mossad agents in 2020. Mossad was involved in an explosion that hit Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in 2021. Israel was also the main regional force that pushed the United States to exert economic and diplomatic pressure on Iran. The policy culminated in the so-called maximum pressure campaign of former President Donald Trump, but none of those policies reached their stated goals. Iran's economy did not collapse, and its nuclear program has accelerated massively after the U.S. quit the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, in 2018.
It's the whole establishment, the whole Israeli establishment, that has this extreme hostility toward Iran and wants to continue to take action in the hopes of provoking something greater. It carries out assassinations, there's no question about that. It carries out bombings inside the country, carried out by covert agents. I think right now the United States government is not wishing to see an escalation into a full-blown war. And Israel does, in the final analysis, have to pay attention to what Washington thinks and says.
Just recently, a top U.S. think tank admitted to Israel's failure towards Iran. A report by Atlantic Council said that Israel's policy has failed to stop Iran. The article said the Tel Aviv regime needs to recalculate and adopt a strategy that corresponds to the current state of the Iranian nuclear program. Given the current state of affairs, the United States, which is Israel's staunch ally, needs to reconsider its unilateral support for Israel.
The spokesman for the UN Secretary General has warned about the situation of the Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip, and the warning has been welcomed by the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. Hamas spokesman Fawzi Barhoum says Stefan Dujarric's comments have put the spotlight on the suffering of the Palestinians in Gaza. He says the international community needs to pressure Israel into lifting the siege. Barhoum says the blockade constitutes a blatant violation of international law. On Monday, the UN official underscored the devastating impacts of the Gaza siege on the people there. He said about 80% of the Gaza population need humanitarian aid. He also said Israel's closure of crossings into Gaza must end, in line with a UN Security Council resolution. Lebanese lawmakers meet with President Aoun for parliamentary consultations to nominate a new prime minister. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has also announced its candidate for the post. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, for more details. Here's more.
The consultations for naming a new prime minister have begun here in Beirut at the presidential palace, because usually based on the constitution, the members of the parliament, they are the ones who vote for a new prime minister by naming who their candidate is, and they come to the president, and the president therefore is forced to accept the name that acquires the majority of votes here at the presidential palace. Now, what we have so far is that Najib Mikati has so far gotten some 31 votes. We have another name that was one of the names that was in a candidate just after Saad Hariri decided to resign previously. That is a name is this person is Nawaf Salam. He is a former ambassador to the UN. This is a name that has been considered unacceptable by some groups, mainly Hezbollah and some of its allies. But you also have many of the members of parliament that have decided not to name anyone. We have also even the Lebanese Forces Party. They had previously named Nawaf Salam, who was the former UN ambassador. And you have, but now they decided not to name anyone. You also have other members of parliament that say they do not want the same faces, the same groups, or the same people, or the same prime ministers that had previously been part of the former economic policies. You have other groups like Hezbollah who do not see eye to eye with Najib Mikati specifically. However, they say that now is not the time to waste any time, and there is no other consensus figure or any other figure right now who is present and ready to continue work. And as you know, this cabinet that will be formed will have a very short lifespan, because after President Michel Aoun steps down towards the end of this year, there needs to be a new cabinet, so it will be automatically in caretaker mode. So therefore, this cabinet would have only around 4 months or so.
Rescuers are racing against time to pull survivors from the rubble a day after a powerful earthquake ripped through the mountainous border region in eastern Afghanistan. Heavy rains, rockfalls, and inaccessible terrain are slowing down the operations. Some 1,000 people have lost their lives, and officials are expecting the death toll to rise. People are digging a large number of graves to bury the dead, mainly in Paktika province that has been hit the hardest. At least 1,500 others have been injured. A number of countries have offered emergency aid. Two humanitarian flights from neighboring Iran have already landed in Afghanistan. The UN says it's deploying health teams and supplies of medicine, food, and emergency shelter to the quake zone. European Union leaders are gathering in Brussels for a summit whose primary focus will be whether or not to grant candidate status to Ukraine.
This is a decisive moment for the European Union. It's also a geopolitical choice that we will make today, and I'm confident that today we will grant the candidate status to Ukraine and to Moldova and express a clear...
The EU heads of state are expecting to sign off on last week's recommendation by the European Commission for Ukraine to join the bloc. Candidate status and the first step towards is the first step towards EU accession, but even if approved, Ukraine will have to wait many years to join. An eventual success will depend on a complicated process of reforms that could take decades to complete. Still, the move will be the symbolic of the European Union's support for Ukraine and its face-off with Russia. President Vladimir Putin has already made it clear that Moscow has nothing against Ukraine joining the EU because it is an economic alliance and not a military one. But Russia is strongly opposed to Ukraine becoming a NATO member. Moving on, turning now to the situation on the ground in Ukraine, where the Russian military is pressing ahead to take control of the eastern Donbass region. Russian forces have already captured two settlements south of the cities of Lysychansk and Severodonetsk, which are currently the focus of its offensive in the east. Many Ukrainian soldiers and around 8,000 civilians are said to be holed up in the twin cities. Pro-Russian forces say they've gained control of a village southwest of Lysychansk. An advisor to Ukraine's president says the fight in the Luhansk region is, in his own words, entering a sort of fearsome climax. Meantime, Kiev is pressing the West, the U.S. in particular, for more heavy weaponry. But Moscow has warned that such arms deliveries would only fuel the flames of war. Our correspondent in Donetsk, Johnny Miller, joined us earlier. He says Ukraine may soon be forced back to the negotiating table, as many believe Kiev cannot sustain a war with Moscow.
There was some hope that the leaders of France, Germany, and Italy, when they came to Kiev a few days ago, would be pushing Ukraine to peace. And they may well have done so behind the scenes. Officially, they're very much backing Ukraine militarily, but there is some speculation that behind the scenes, they may well have pushed Ukraine to start negotiating. There are some other calls from some individuals in America, for example, that signaling that Ukraine cannot win this war, and so we need to start pushing Ukraine to negotiating table. And if Ukraine does seem to does lose the Donbass region soon, there's going to be more and more calls for Ukraine to negotiate, because continuing to fight with the kind of losses that Ukraine are sustaining, some estimates range from over 600 to 1,000 casualties every day. Those losses are simply unsustainable. So if Ukraine continues with those losses, it may well be forced to negotiating table.
An industry watchdog survey reveals Britain's economy is showing signs of stalling as high inflation threatens a recession in the United Kingdom. The S&P Global's Purchasing Managers Index, or PMI, shows UK firms have been hit by a slowdown in new orders. Moreover, business confidence has fallen to its weakest since last year. In addition, UK private sector firms say demand has been hit by purchase hesitancy and squeezed budgets due to high inflation. June's PMI figures didn't change, showing the slowest economic growth rate in a year. Meanwhile, Britons are paying higher living costs and fuel prices as national inflation climbs to 9.1%. That's the highest it has been in the past 40 years. And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The outgoing United Nations climate chief warned that a victory by Donald Trump or any other ally of the fossil fuel industry in the 2024 U.S. presidential election would represent a fatal setback for efforts to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading UN Climate Chief Warns Trump Win in 2024 Would Spell Disaster for Planet. Here's more. The The outgoing United Nations climate chief warned recently that a victory by Donald Trump or any other ally of fossil fuel industry in the United States in the 2024 U.S. presidential election would represent a fatal setback for efforts to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. Well, yes, Patricia Espinosa, executive secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, said. UNFCCC told Politico when asked whether Trump or another Republican president similarly hostile to climate action would spell doom for the Paris Agreement's lower-end warming target. Leadership was not there on climate during Trump's 4 years in office, Espinosa said in an interview on the sidelines of the ongoing climate conference in Bonn, Germany. She added, "We didn't manage to get the same level of traction in the process." The prospect of a Republican win in 2024 is highly unnerving for climate advocates, given the party's fealty to the fossil fuel industry and opposition to even the most basic emissions reduction policies. It's not clear how other potential Republican presidential contenders, from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis to Senator Tom Cotton, would substantively differ from Trump on climate. "The climate's always been changing," Trump said in Fox News interview in March, pushing several denialist talking points. During his 4 years in the White House, Trump formally withdrew the U.S. from the legally binding Paris Accord, opened up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and other pristine lands and waters to drilling, and went on a sprawling deregulatory frenzy that rewarded the fossil fuel industry at the expense of the environment and public health. The former president also packed his cabinet and other key posts with close friends of the fossil fuel industry. Given his disastrous climate record, it's no surprise that the planetary consequences of another Trump term were a major topic ahead of the 2020 presidential election. Michael Mann, a leading climate scientist, warned months ahead of the contest that a second Trump term is game over for the climate. "If we are going to avert ever more catastrophic climate change impacts, we need to limit warming below a degree and a half Celsius, a little less than 3 degrees Fahrenheit," Mann said, adding, "Another 4 years of what we have seen under Trump, which is to outsource environmental and energy policy to the polluters and dismantle protections put in place by the previous administration, would make that essentially impossible." Scientists have been sounding the alarm for years that a breach of the treaty's 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold would mean even more devastating extreme weather, flooding, displacement, a mass coral reef die-off, and other harmful impacts. While he won praise for rejoining the Paris Accord, Biden's overall climate record has not exactly stoked activists who were, and still are, expecting bold action from the administration. Just last week, Biden boasted that under his leadership, the U.S. is on track to produce a record amount of oil next year, adding he is working with industry to accelerate this output in an effort to rein in soaring prices at the pump. Climate advocates have also voiced alarm at federal data showing that the Biden administration approved more permits for oil and gas drilling on public lands during its first year in power than the Trump administration did in 2017. Meanwhile, the billions of dollars in renewable energy investments that Biden campaigned on remain stalled in the U.S. Senate, largely due to Senator Joe Manchin, a top ally of the fossil fuel industry. He can't be the climate president when he refuses to play hardball with Joe Manchin and corporate politicians who have prevented the passage of a historic climate bill that will save lives across the country. Sunrise Movement Executive Director Varshini Prakash said in January's assessment of Biden's first year in the White House. Put simply, he needs to act with the urgency and courage that the climate crisis demands, said Prakash, adding, doing anything less risk young people's support and Democrats' already slim majorities in the House and the Senate.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Now, it is interesting to know that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the testamentary trustee and he was the seventh divinely appointed successor, vice regent, Imam of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was also the testamentary trustee and the only successor of the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. It is interesting, but we find in the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam that he went through great ordeals, difficulties, trials, tribulations, troublesome afflictions, and it was not limited to these. Matter of fact, Imam al-Kadhim was held hostage in prisons. He was put through pain and torture, and it can be said that he was very much like the Messiah, Isa ibn Maryam, in his devotions, his piety, and his asceticism. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام مثل الدنيا مثل الحية مسها لين وفي جوفها السم القاتل يحذرها الرجال ذو العقول ويهوي إليها الصبيان بأيديهم
Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam stated, "The parable of this world is like that of a snake. It is soft to touch, but it contains a deadly poison. Men of intellect are cautious, whereas children extend their arms toward it."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. When talking about the conversations and the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence, the seventh divinely appointed Imam, talked about a whole range of ideas, a whole vast variety of ideological concepts, which really can help every single one of us. It is interesting, but one of the companions of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he talked about the difference between the ignorant, the jahil, and the wise, those who know, the ahl al-ma'rifa, the people of knowledge. And so in response, Imam al-Kadhim said to the companion that the ignorant wonder at the wise more so than the wise wonder upon the ignorant. It's interesting, some of these statements that we find from the divinely appointed imams, of course, because these statements are sourced in the ultimate source of knowledge and wisdom, which is the Almighty Allah. Because of this source that they are connected to, sometimes it is a little bit difficult for us to understand the complexity and the profundity of what is being said. In this seemingly simple statement of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that he says that the ignorant wonder at the wise, and truly that's how it is, because the wise know more than, for example, we, the less learned and or the ignorant, for a lack of a better term. Because the wise men know more than we do, we truly tend to be kind of amazed and wonder at the things that they say or the actions that they commit. Of course, we realize that because they are wise, because they are learned, because they are scholars, we tend to trust what they do. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we always understand why it is what they are doing. But on the other hand, Imam al-Kadhim says that the wise, they very rarely wonder about the ignorant, why the ignorant or less educated are doing what they are doing. And again, a potential understanding of this statement is that the wise are thinking about higher levels of knowledge. They are thinking about deeper concepts of the Holy Quran, or deeper ideological understandings of the deen, of the religion, of Islam, or the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. And so the wise are thinking about these things as compared to thinking about why the uneducated, the ones who are not learned or who aren't scholars, or again, who are ignorant for lack of a better word, they don't wonder at what they are doing because they are wondering at the sciences and the knowledge and the wisdom of the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them, and ultimately the Almighty Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
The aspect of, or I should say, one of the aspects that made the imamah of Imam al-Kadhim salamullah alayhi very critical is the conditions that ended up being the conditions of the Ummah and the conditions of the movements of the Ahlul Bayt during that period. For various reasons, keeping the movement of the Ahlul Bayt, the political movement to overthrow any unjust rule and to establish the government of justice led by the Ahlul Bayt, salamullah alayhim ajma'in, was very difficult. Imam al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, managed to keep this alive, strengthen it, give it more momentum, which led to the shahada, the imprisonment, and then the shahada of Imam al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi. Imam al-Kadhim kept the movement of the Ahlul Bayt alive, the political movement of the Ahlul Bayt alive. And not only that, he strengthened it, added more momentum by adding more people to the movement, more followers, and more energy to those followers. Salamullah alayhi.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., the House Committee investigating the January 6th attack directly tied Donald J. Trump on Tuesday, 21st of June, to a scheme to put forward fake slates of pro-Trump electors and presented fresh details on how the former president sought to bully, cajole and bluff his way into invalidating his 2020 defeat in states around the country. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Luke Broadwater and Alan Feuer. The piece is titled Panel Ties Trump to Fake Electoral Plan, Mapping His Attack on Democracy. In the U.S., the House Committee investigating the January 6th attack directly tied Donald J. Trump on Tuesday, 21st of June, to a scheme to put forward fake slates of pro-Trump electors and presented fresh details on how the former president sought to bully, cajole and bluff his way into invalidating his 2020 defeat in states around the country. Using sworn in-person testimony from Republicans and videotaped depositions from other officials, the House panel showed how the former president and a group of his allies laid siege to state lawmakers and election officials after the balloting in a wide-ranging plot to reverse the outcome of the election. The campaign led to harassment and threats of violence against anyone who resisted. The hearing on Tuesday, 21st of June, amounted to the most comprehensive picture to date of a president who directed an attack on democracy itself and repeatedly reached into its essential machinery, the administration of free and fair elections. It was the committee's fourth hearing, and it captured how, long before a throng of his supporters stormed the Capitol on 6th of January 2021, Donald Trump used election lies to whip up violence against anyone who dared deny his false claims of victory. The president's lie was and is a dangerous cancer on the body politic, said Representative Adam Schiff, the California Democrat who led the questioning on Tuesday. If you can convince Americans they cannot trust their own elections, that any time they lose is somehow illegitimate, then what is left but violence to determine who should govern? Over nearly 3 hours, the House committee demonstrated how Donald Trump and his supporters, including his personal lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, and his chief of staff, Mark Meadows, sought to persuade state officials to avoid certifying vote counts to give Donald Trump a victory in the Electoral College. Donald Trump also sought to persuade lawmakers to create the slates of alternate electors, hoping that Vice President Mike Pence might use them to subvert the normal democratic process when he oversaw the official count of electoral votes on 6th of January 2021. And the panel presented evidence tying Representative Andy Biggs of Arizona and Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin to the plan. The House committee offered testimony from four public servants who stood up to the former president, rejecting his increasingly desperate pleas for help, often at great personal expense. "I didn't want to be used as a pawn," Rusty Bowers, the Speaker of the Arizona House of Representatives, testified. Rusty Bowers, a Republican, told the committee that he rebuffed Donald Trump's attempts to get him to create slates of pro-Trump electors in his state, Arizona, explaining to the former president, "You are asking me to do something against my oath, and I will not break my oath." Such defiance, however, came at a cost. Rusty Bowers told the committee that after bucking Donald Trump, a truck was driven through his neighborhood, playing a recording that declared him to be a pedophile. Mr. Bowers, who spoke about the Constitution in reverential and spiritual terms, had tears in his eyes as he described his gravely ill daughter enduring some of the harassment outside their house. Her daughter died last year. In similar fashion, Brad Raffensperger, Georgia Secretary of State, testified that after he turned down Donald Trump's request in a phone call to find the votes that would throw him the election, his wife of 40 years received threats by text and people broke into their daughter-in-law's house. "It's turned my life upside down." Wondria Moss, a Georgia election worker who was implicated by name in one of Donald Trump's false election fraud allegations, said in her own emotional testimony. Wondria Moss, who is known as Shay, added, "It's affected my life in a major way, in every way, all because of lies." And the panel contrasted the willingness of the four officials to speak out with the refusal of many of Donald Trump's allies and others around him to tell investigators what they know. In particular, Representative Liz Cheney, a Republican of Wyoming, and the panel's vice chairwoman, singled out Pat Cipollone, Donald Trump's White House counsel who repeatedly pushed back on his efforts to overturn the election. "Our committee is certain that Donald Trump does not want Mr. Cipollone to testify here," Liz Cheney said, "but we think the American people deserve to hear from Mr. Cipollone personally. He should appear before this House committee, and we're working to secure his testimony." The plan to enlist the help of state lawmakers to create fake slates of electors appears to have begun just days after the election, when a pro-Trump lawyer, Cleta Mitchell, sent an email suggesting the idea to John Eastman, another lawyer close to Donald Trump. "A movement is stirring," Ms. Mitchell wrote in the email, introduced as evidence at the hearing, "but needs constitutional support." By 18th of November 2020, the committee said another pro-Trump lawyer, Kenneth Chesbrough, had joined the effort, writing a memo suggesting that the Trump campaign should organize its allies in several swing states to draft fake slates of electors. Around Thanksgiving, still others signed onto the plan, including Rudolph Giuliani and Mark Meadows, according to a recorded deposition from Cassidy Hutchinson, an aide to Mark Meadows. Eventually, the Republican National Committee, the RNC, was brought in as well. Ronna McDaniel, the group's chairwoman, said in a recorded deposition played at the hearing. Ronna McDaniel testified that during a call with Donald Trump, he put John Eastman on the phone with her to talk about the importance of the Republican National Committee helping the campaign gather these contingent electors. All of this was allowed to go forward despite the fact that several lawyers for the Trump campaign felt it was illegal. The White House counsel's office said as much during a meeting with Mark Meadows and Rudolph Giuliani, according to Ms. Hutchinson. And even those pushing the scheme conceded it was groundless. "We've got lots of theories," Rusty Boas recalled Mr. Giuliani saying at a meeting with Arizona legislators. "We just don't have the evidence." On another occasion, as Rusty Boas questioned John Eastman about how there could possibly be a legal way for him to simply name new electors, the lawyer had no answer, replying, "Just do it and let the courts work it out." Even after Arizona had certified its electors, John Eastman and Andy Biggs called Rusty Boas, pushing him to launch a fresh attempt to decertify the vote after the fact. Brad Raffensperger and Gabrielle Sterling, Georgia's top two election officials, recounted a similar story. Pressure from Donald Trump to overturn the election that ultimately led to threats and intimidation when they pushed back. Mr. Raffensperger was on a call with Donald Trump on 3rd of January 2021, during which Donald Trump pushed him to find enough votes to overturn the outcome of the election and vaguely threatened him with a criminal offence. Gabrielle Sterling is perhaps best known for having given an impassioned speech on 1st of December 2020 in which she addressed Donald Trump directly, telling him that his lies about the election were leading to violence against election workers. "It has all gone too far, all of it," Gabrielle Sterling said in a speech that was played at the hearing. He added, "It has to stop. Mr. President, you have not condemned these actions or this language." Shortly after the election, Donald Trump and his allies seized on conspiracy theories, falsely claiming that election workers in Atlanta, Georgia, had been caught on video quietly taking thousands of ballots from a suitcase and feeding them into counting machines. Even though the allegations were quickly investigated and debunked, Gabrielle Sterling said, Donald Trump and his lawyers continued to push the claims in public and on social media sites. Fighting back against this flood of misinformation, Gabrielle Sterling says, was like a shovel trying to empty the ocean. The committee showed the breathtaking sweep of the pressure campaign across seven states, playing clips from officials in Michigan and Pennsylvania who were inundated with thousands of text messages, phone calls, protesters near their homes and threats. At one point, Brian Cutler, the Republican House Speaker in Pennsylvania, asked Donald Trump's legal team to stop its daily phone calls to him because they were inappropriate. The plan found eager allies in Congress, however. The committee showed texts that an aide to Ron Johnson had sent to an aide to Mike Pence, indicating that Mr. Johnson wanted to hand deliver a slate of fake electors from Wisconsin to the vice president on 6th of January. Mike Pence's aide responded, "Do not give that to him." A spokesman for Ron Johnson on Tuesday blamed the exchange on his chief of staff, saying that the senator had no involvement in creating an alternate set of electors. The hearing ended with testimony from Ms. Moss, an election worker who processed votes with her mother, Ruby Freeman, in Atlanta, Georgia, on Election Day. In early December, Rudolph Giuliani appeared at a Slate legislative hearing in Georgia and falsely accused her and her mother of taking ballots from a suitcase and illegally running them through voting machines. Mr. Giuliani's baseless allegations were amplified by right-wing media outlets and by Donald Trump himself, who mentioned Ms. Moss's name several times during his call with Brad Raffensperger. After the accusations went viral, Ms. Moss was subjected to racist threats by phone and text and became afraid to leave her home. She told the committee that her mother fled her home after the FBI warned her that she could be in danger. Ms. Moss also recalled a panicked phone call from her septuagenarian grandmother, who said people had arrived at her home seeking to make a citizen's arrest of Ms. Moss.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, so I and love's for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a very beautiful and noble hadith, which has been narrated from the Holy Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. This hadith is about what takes away the splendor and the awe from that others have for Muslims from the hearts of the non-Muslims, right? And the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam was once surrounded by his companions, and he made a prediction. He made a prediction regarding the future concerning the Muslim nation. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Soon, very soon, other communities will attack you." Like the attack of a hungry man towards a bowl of food. One of his companions who was there, he said the following. He asked the Prophet, "Will we be a minority then?" This person assumed that, you know, these other people would be attacking them because they would be a minority and they would be outnumbered by the non-Muslims, and because of this, the non-Muslims would get the courage and feel the strength to attack these Muslims. So the Prophet replied and said, "No, you will be the majority," meaning you will outnumber them, "but you will be like the scum of the flood," meaning you will be worthless, you will be unable to overpower your enemies. "And in fact," the Prophet continued, "Allah will snatch away the awe that your enemy has of you." Meaning the enemies will no longer fear you, even though you have a lot of numbers, you know, you are in the majority, you outnumber the enemy, but still the enemy will not fear you. And because of that, because obviously when the opposition doesn't fear you, they will be able to overcome you and they will attack you. The Prophet continued and said, "And he will cast weakness in your heart." God will cast weakness into your hearts. One of the companions who was present there, he asked the Prophet and said, "What is that weakness? What is that weakness? Or what is the cause of that weakness? How does that weakness come about? What led to that weakness of the heart, of the ambition, or of the courage of the Muslims?" So the Prophet said, "That will be because of love of the world, hubbud dunya, and dislike of death, wakarahiyatul maut." These two would be the cause of the weakness of your heart. Obviously, when somebody fears death, obviously he won't have the courage to defend his nation from the attacks of outsiders and enemies. Or when he loves the world, right? When he loves the world, this is also one of the reasons that would lead to the weakness of his heart, the diminishing of his courage, and then his inability to defend himself and his nation from the attacks of the outsiders. This is the reason for this spiritual weakness and this lack of courage. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at what takes away the splendor of the Muslim community, in the words of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin.
محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in.